This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you this Saturday morning once again. And we have an exciting show planned. My guest today, I have two guests coming in. Dr. Mary Gina Rochford will be with us, who is the medical director of Rochford Eye Center and also an ophthalmologic surgeon. So she'll be with us in the second half hour. In the second segment of the show, we're going to have Dr. Daniel Condit. He's a pulmonologist, a medical doctor, pulmonologist at St. Francis Hospital. And we're going to be talking about pneumonia and the various types, because that's what we're getting into here. This is the reason we are going out and getting our COVID vaccines, flu vaccines, to avoid pneumonia. So he's going to talk to us about the basics and what we need, when we need to go out and get care. Before we start, a message of thanks. I want to thank one of our regular listeners, Daniel, who I met last evening at the Mohegan Sun Casino. Daniel works in the security department, and I don't think people know this, but every year, if you're a physician working at Mohegan Sun, as I am, as a vendor, you have to present your license, proof of medical malpractice insurance, and things such as that. At Mohegan Sun, they don't just let doctors come in to take care of athletes. Doctors can come in from other states, but their regulations say that a Connecticut licensed physician must be present to make sure whatever is going on is above board. Same thing with performers. So every year you have to go through licensing. I've been there since the casinos opened, and it's a complicated process because it involves several different departments, security, risk management. Well, mine lapsed on October 1st. I found out yesterday when I was there to do physicals, and Daniel expedited my licensing. He knew who to call, what documents to get, and they were able to do that. And it's always great to chat with regular listeners to the program. So again, thank you to Daniel. This day in medicine, October 4th, 1883, Dr. William Gibson Bonwill. Dr. Bonwill was born. He was born in 1883, as I mentioned today, and he's an American physician. And he was also a surgeon and a dentist at the time. And there was a lot of overlapping back then. But he had a lot of inventions. And one of the ones most prominent is he invented the first all-porcelain tooth crown. As we know, again, you know, things that are still used. Now, gold was used for a long period of time and is still used to some degree. But to be able to use porcelain was new, and it was one of his many, many contributions to medicine. So we remember Dr. Bonwill today. A couple of things. You know, we're hearing a lot about immigration and health. I mean, you can't turn on a TV or open a newspaper, but I have to tell you personally, I feel like I'm sitting there watching a car accident happen. You know what I mean, folks? I mean, you know what it is. And our problem is this. When you deal with infectious diseases and you deal, as we'll talk with Dr. Condit about, these are respiratory diseases that are spread. And what we need to do as people is make sure everybody we come in contact with is safe. Whether they have a pneumonia or some other condition, get it treated. Did they get vaccinated? Because no matter what their legal status is, They are in our grocery stores, our schools. We're coming in contact with people. And I say this because there's been a tremendous drop-off in people who are immigrants, both here legally and illegally, in seeking medical care. They don't want to go to the doctor's office. They don't want to go to a hospital. They'll only go to the hospital when it's in an extreme situation, for which we all pay anyhow. So the point here is it's an obligation of ours to protect ourselves, to make sure people feel free to go to certain places. And that's where we get into what has become a dirty term, sanctuary, right? So hospitals were sanctuary places. Doctors' offices should be sanctuary places. You should be able to go there and not fear that there's an ICE agent in the waiting room ready to send you back to wherever the case may be. So taking the politics out of it, just look at the health from that standpoint. And you'll see that it behooves us to make sure somehow anybody in our borders or anybody we're coming in contact with is getting proper treatment. It's imperative to do that to protect ourselves and our children. But once again, this week, RFK Jr. is leading the stupid train again. And I hate to use that term, but it's gotten that ridiculous. Last week on this program, we talked about how vaccines saved 300 million lives in the 20th century just from smallpox. Other than being able to purify water, vaccines have been the single greatest contribution to humanity. And instead, he has come back with a press conference this week talking about how vaccines didn't make that much of a difference in polio and rubella. So since he picked on those two, I'm going to go right to them. And he talked about others. Let's look at the data. These are hard facts. If you look at the number of cases of polio in the 1950s, from 1950 to 1955, we're looking at over 50,000 cases a year. In 1955, the vaccine was introduced on a large scale. Those numbers dropped to the point where in 1965, you didn't see polio in the United States. That's the dramatic effect that the vaccine has had. It wasn't because somebody decided on some natural remedy, some salve. It was a polio vaccine. Rubella, same thing. And again, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember rubella will remember that many children were born deaf because their mothers contracted rubella in the early 1960s. The vaccine in that case was introduced in about 1969. And by 1993, there were no more cases in the United States. So don't pay attention to the lies. I'm tired of these press conferences where he's up spouting off lies. And we have Dr. Oz. There's another one. Dr. Oz, a reputable cardiac surgeon, is in the background nodding his head in agreement. I don't know what it takes to do that, to reach that low point. What someone has to do to get you to take your reputation as someone who could open someone's chest, open their heart and save their lives, to just nodding your head to what you know is nonsense. That's how bad this situation has become. But thanks to the listeners on this program, we will keep you informed. And you can always reach me at info@alessimd.com for whatever it is and questions you may have even after this show goes away at the end of the year. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Daniel Condit. He's a pulmonologist, and we're going to be talking about pneumonia. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest Dr. Daniel Condit. Dr. Condit is a specialist in pulmonary diseases and critical care medicine at St. Francis Hospital, and he's agreed to join us to talk a little bit about pneumonia and the flu and how these infections affect our lungs. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Alessi. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk. Let's get to the basics. What is pneumonia?
So that's a great question. So pneumonia is a common infection that can occur in the lungs. And to start off, I'd like to begin with a little bit of anatomy lesson. The lungs essentially are the main organ for respiration. They allow for exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, that is oxygen from the air that goes into your bloodstream and powers your cells and tissues to do all of the functions of your organs and body, and then carbon dioxide being the metabolic waste product that is that you breathe out into the air. And this occurs in the tiny air sacs of the lung called the alveoli. And pneumonia really refers to infection or inflammation of those tiny air sacs.
And how does that differ from someone who has bronchitis or asthma?
So bronchitis, in order for the air to get into those air sacs, it needs to travel through our airways or windpipes, and we call those bronchi. And bronchitis refers to infection or inflammation of those windpipes called the bronchi.
So when we think about types of pneumonia and types of bronchitis, I guess we think, you know, broadly of viral versus bacterial. You know, and one of the terms we commonly hear is, oh, I had double pneumonia. Can you explain the term double pneumonia? Does it mean it affected both lungs, or did they get it twice? Can you explain that term for us?
You know, what's interesting is that I hear that term all the time from my patients, and it's not really a term I ever learned in medical school. Generally, what I take it as is that it is pneumonia in each of the lungs at the same time, or your right and your left lung. And oftentimes, this can be caused by bacteria as well as viruses.
Okay. As long as we don't get to triple pneumonia, I guess we're okay.
Hopefully not.
But let's talk to you about what's the difference between a viral pneumonia and a bacterial pneumonia?
No, so that's a great question. So as we know, as I explained, pneumonia generally refers to infections of the air sacs. And when the infections are caused by a virus, we call that a viral pneumonia. When they're caused by bacteria, it's called a bacterial pneumonia. Common causes of viral pneumonia include COVID-19, influenza, and what's becoming more increasingly recognized as an important cause of viral pneumonia, respiratory syncytial virus. Bacteria can also cause pneumonia, and that's, I think, what we more typically think of when we think pneumonia. And bacterial pneumonia infections can actually cause, generally, now this is excluding the COVID-19 pandemic, can cause more serious illness, placing patients at risk of requiring supplemental oxygen or even hospitalization.
Is one worse than the other?
So it really depends. I would say in general, bacterial pneumonias are worse. However, what you saw in the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as some cases of the flu, is that these viral pneumonias can potentially cause a very robust immune response that can make patients very sick, life-threateningly sick, putting them in the intensive care unit, causing them to be hospitalized or be put in the intensive care unit. Generally, outside of this robust immune response that we can sometimes see in viral pneumonias, typically, bacterial pneumonias will cause more serious illness than your typical viral pneumonia.
And so how does someone get pneumonia? Is it only because of respiratory contact, like we learned during COVID? Is that how, even how you get bacterial?
You know, bacterial pneumonia can be caused a number of different ways. Being in close contact with someone who's infected with pneumonia, certainly the disease can spread. Other things, too, that can lead to pneumonia are aspiration. And what I mean by aspiration is if oral contents or stomach contents enter the windpipe and into the airways where they shouldn't normally enter. And certain conditions can put you at risk for that if someone is altered, drinks and is intoxicated quite commonly, or patients who have suffered from serious strokes who have trouble swallowing, they can be at risk of these aspiration pneumonias. And then oftentimes, viral infections such as viral bronchitis or viral pneumonias can place our bodies at risk of what we call a superimposed bacterial pneumonia.
So you could get two at the same time?
You could, yes. Or okay. Usually it will be one followed by the other.
Okay. When we think about trends, now I know we always get our flu vaccines now. Is it because fall and winter is when you see the most pneumonia as opposed to when the climate is warmer? Or does it have to do with people being outside versus inside? What are the factors that affect this trend from going up?
I do think exactly what you just said. In the fall, in winter months, at least in New England, as we all know, it gets colder, the weather conditions get harsher, people are indoors in close contact where these infections, whether viral or bacterial, can more easily spread from one person to another.
Well, let's move on to my favorite topic, which seems to be vaccines, because we have ways of avoiding this. And I'd like to start with the bacterial one, since that's what we see the most of, the Pneumovax. Is that what we're still using? Is it still Pneumovax? I know it changes. How often does someone need to get that?
Well, we actually have a newer pneumonia vaccine called the PCV20. And generally, it's recommended for all adults 65 years or older, because what we found is that older adults are at a higher risk of becoming more seriously ill from these bacterial pneumonias as well as viral pneumonias. But we will also give the pneumonia vaccine to younger patients who have conditions that also put them at risk of getting more seriously ill. These conditions include chronic heart and lung conditions. Heart conditions include things like congestive heart failure and coronary artery disease. Lung conditions include chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is typically associated with smoking, asthma, conditions that cause scarring of the lungs. But this can also include other conditions like cancer or being on chronic steroids, which suppresses your immune system. Or having some kind of heritable or like immunodeficiency where just based on who you are and how your immune system works, there are impairments that put you at higher risk of becoming seriously ill.
So anyone over 65 needs to get a pneumonia vaccine. That's the recommendation. Anybody with an
generally.
Illness? Okay. And that is not Pneumovax. There's another one, and that's the one they should get.
I would recommend it because generally this one, so there were two previous pneumonia vaccines and there was a complicated dosing schedule. I actually really like this new one called the PCV20 because it's really a one and done. And it covers all of the different variants of pneumococcus, which is the most common cause of bacterial pneumonia, that were kind of split between these two prior vaccines. The newest one called the PCV20 makes it very easy.
Is that Prevnar? Is that the PCV20? Is that the brand name? I think that's
yes,
it.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. We've got a minute left. Can you just tell everybody we're talking about RSV COVID. who should get the shot by your recommendation of your patients? Who are you telling to make sure they get vaccinated?
So what I tell my patients is I think older adults, 60 to 65 years or older, adults with chronic heart or lung conditions, adults with immunocompromising conditions, I definitely, what I would tell my patients if they fulfill any one of those criteria, I would recommend both the COVID-19 vaccine as well as the RSV vaccine. I would also recommend the COVID-19 vaccine to someone who's never previously been vaccinated against it. And but, you know, it's, we're seeing in general less serious illness just due to the vaccines being available now for several years, as well as, you know, herd immunity.
That's great. But, well, listen, thank you very much, Dan. Thank you for your time, and thanks for everything you do for our community. Next up, we're going to, you're great. You're welcome. Thank you very much. And next up, we're going to be chatting with Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest once again, Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. She is the founder of the Ratchford Eye Center. She is a medical doctor and eye surgeon at 1166 Farmington Avenue in Berlin, Connecticut. And Mary Gina, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Alessi. I'm happy to be here.
I want to just take a minute to publicly thank you. This past week, I had an eye emergency and went to your office. I didn't know it was an emergency till I got to your office. And I want to thank you because your staff got me right in. They were very professional, moved quickly. And it's not just because, oh, well, yeah, he's a doctor. I hear this from everybody who I refer over there, whether they are listeners emailing me, whether it's my own family or other patients I've referred over, to the professionalism of your staff and how you folks operate. I mean, thankfully, you got me over to Dr. Budoff over at Retina Consultants and headed off what could have been a real problem for me. And I'm feeling much better right now, thanks to you. So I wanted to thank you publicly for that.
That really, really means a lot. And I do think that at the end of the day, we are still doctors. We're still medical professionals. We still, you know, really want to be there for our patients, no matter who they are. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I will extend the word to my staff because, you know, they work very hard, as I know most people in the medical field do, and it's nice to get the recognition.
Well, let's move on. What are the most common eye conditions you see in the office now?
Yeah, so my population is skewed, you know, toward the older end of the spectrum. So I have two optometrists in my office, and they are, you know, doctors of optometry. And their focus is really, you know, looking at the ocular health, giving someone glasses or contacts, correcting what we call a refractive error, and doing, you know, some medical triage of, you know, eye disease in their area. So they tend to see, you know, younger folks. In my end of the office, I tend to do, you know, the older population, you know, not that 55 is old, but like 55 and older. So I have a mix of both eye issues and issues that can affect somebody due to their underlying medical conditions. So, you know, by far and away, we do a lot of cataracts just because everyone will develop a cataract no matter how healthy they are if they live long enough, and the cataracts will impact your ability to do the things that you want to do and need to do no matter what that might be. The second thing I probably see most is diabetic retinopathy. You know, there's a lot of diabetics, I think, you know, being diagnosed earlier. And so everybody who has diabetes needs to be screened for diabetic eye disease. So we do a lot of those. And again, if they have advanced disease, we send them over to the retina group, as you mentioned earlier, for injections of the eye, which is how we treat diabetes these days. I think the third thing I see, just because that's my specialty, is glaucoma. And glaucoma you know, is a little bit of a difficult condition to diagnose sometimes, because it's a problem where your eye pressure is higher than normal. And over time, that pressure can begin to injure the optic nerve. But because there's redundancy in the optic nerve, there's a lot of extra fibers. You may not notice any trouble until you start to develop damage. So I do see a lot of, you know, glaucoma that would require either some of the early treatments that we do, drops, laser, or then, of course, more advanced cases that would require surgical intervention. And then the fourth thing is probably macular degeneration, where, again, our general population is living longer, the disease is becoming more prevalent, and so screening and then treatment for macular degeneration is probably the fourth thing I see. And I actually have to add into there dry eye, because dry eye is another, I think, eye condition that's becoming more and more pronounced, just given all of the time that we spend on our screens, our phones, and that can also contribute to a lot of ocular symptoms.
Since you're on the topic, there are more different types of eye drops over the counter for dry eye. Are some better than others? And I was looking at this the other day in preparation for this interview. Some say gel, some say longer acting. Is there a difference? I mean, there are multiple shelves of these.
Yeah,
so is there some indication, something we could share with the listeners that makes some better than others or more appropriate than others?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Okay, so I think the big differential from the beginning is a preserved versus a non-preserved drop. So the ones that come in the big bottle typically have preservatives in there. Most people are okay with the preservative drops just because you can keep the bottle with you a little bit longer. If you are experiencing, you know, true dry eye syndromes, then I do prefer the preservative-free ones. You know, they're less sort of toxic to the ocular surface. And then the next sort of category is sort of short versus long acting. And those are where you get into the gel drops versus the, you know, sort of, I'm not going to say, so the regular eye drops. So the gel drops have a little bit of a thicker vehicle to it. So they can be more mineral oil based. They can last a little bit longer. Sometimes because they're thick, they can blur the vision. So I tend to recommend those at night so they can repair the corneal surface, you know, at, while you're sleeping, and you can wake up, you know, feeling a little bit better. So the other, and the other ones can be components that, quote, get the red out. Tetrahydrozoline is one of those. So even they can make you look better. Sometimes that tetrahydrozoline can give you a rebound redness. So I tend to avoid those just for everyday use. The rest of it's glycerin, you know, polyethylene glycol. Those are lubricants that are effective in terms of just rehydrating that surface of the eye.
Are some of the conditions you see more seasonal than others in terms of just in general? Do you see, you know, more glaucoma in any particular season, or dry eye in a more particular season?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, glaucoma is, it can have a diurnal fluctuation where if I check somebody's pressure, it might be higher in the morning versus the afternoon. So that may be more of a daily, hourly sort of fluctuation. As far as seasonals go, definitely dry eye is way worse in the winter because we're indoors more. We might be doing more screen time. There's more evaporation of the tears. So we definitely see more of that in the winter time. And in fact, now I sort of prepare my patients that are coming in now, make sure you got those drops around, make sure you be, you know, get into a schedule where you're not going to forget, you know, keep them on a regular basis. Seasonal, of course, with allergies, we definitely see, you know, spikes in spring and fall where things start to bloom and the leaves start to fall. And that's that sort of itchy, runny eyes, tearing, your nose starts to run, you feel a little bit congested. And then there's different drops for that. We like over-the-counter antihistamine and mast cell stabilizers for those. And there's a host of the anti-allergy eye drops over-the-counter as well.
You mentioned the retina, but and I want to get to that. But can you explain, like, the differences in things you see in the office that affect, say, the cornea versus the lens versus the retina, kind of in broad categories?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when we think about how your eye sees, there's a light that comes from a source, and it has to focus through the structures in the front of the eye. Those are the focusing mechanisms, like a camera, right? So there's the cornea, which bends the light, and then there's a lens behind it, which focuses the light. And sometimes those two things don't match up, and the light doesn't perfectly get centered on the retina, and that's why we would need glasses. There's a gel of the eye in between, and I know you've talked about floaters on your show before,
sure.
But that gel is where all that debris kind of lands, and there's protein strands that begin to move around, and so the light has to pass through that, and that's why you get some interference. And then the retina and the optic nerve are really the guts of the eye, where the light gets absorbed by the receptors in the retina, and then it travels through the optic nerve to the brain and gets plugged into various places in your brain to see. So a lot of your vision actually is in your brain. So things that can affect the cornea and the lens really make your vision sort of blurry, out of focus, and fuzzy. So that would be dry eye. There are lots of viral infections that can affect the cornea, like herpes simplex virus, again, conjunctivitis, that's sort of the front part of the eye. There are diseases inherent in the cornea, such as Fuchs dystrophy. They can affect certain cells. But any way that the cornea gets cloudy, it's going to impact the vision. And some of those lend themselves to treatment. We can now replace parts of the cornea to get that clear again. And some of them are treated with medicines like the dry eye. And then the lens, early in your life, the lens is clear and flexible. And as you get older, the lens loses its flexibility. And that's why around age 40 to 45, we all start to need reading glasses. And then when that lens gets cloudy, that's what we term a cataract. And then we have methods to replace that cloudy lens with a new one and restore your vision. When it comes to the retina and the optic nerve, those are, you know, where it's not quite so straightforward in how we can sort of fix those. So common things we see with the retina can be related to your circulation, such as diabetes, hypertension, you know, things like that, where the circulation can be affected. You know, within the retina, there's a certain specific area called the macula. And the macula, you might hear about for macular degeneration. There's a degeneration of those cells. We have new treatments for macular degeneration, whether it's dry or wet. But if those cells become affected, it can be a little bit more, you know, it can really impact your vision over your lifetime. And then the optic nerve, again, that's part of your central nervous system. So as you know, if you've had a stroke or something, there may not be ability to recover. The same thing with the optic nerve. And those are things like glaucoma. But we see optic nerve issues in conditions such as, you know, malnutrition or multiple sclerosis or, you know, any of those conditions that can certainly affect the function of the optic nerve. And then any neurologic conditions such as a stroke, and broadly speaking, can affect that brain part of your vision. So when you go for an eye exam, we really do try to isolate each one of those areas, do some specific testing if we're suspicious about something. But, you know, your eye is pretty complex, even though you might think, well, I just need a pair of glasses. You know, there's a lot more involved.
You know, when I think of losing flexibility as I get older, I never really thought of my lens, I could tell you that. But I guess it goes to show that you really need to have that variability in your eye. I have a question here from Bob, and that is, can glasses be used to correct a retinal problem?
A retina problem?
Yeah, a retina problem.
Yeah. So, you know, glasses can give the light an ability to focus more sharply on the retina. So that's the job of the glasses. It just focuses the light. It's like, you know, it can just bend how the light gets in there. But the vision will be determined by the health of your retina. So certainly there are some conditions we can make your vision better with glasses, but there are certainly some retinal conditions where glasses give you limited benefit. And then we go to things like low vision aids, where we can magnify the things you want to read a little bit more, or other devices, whether they're electronic or digital, that might help to give you the best use of the vision that you have.
Another question from Mary was, how does the iris affect vision?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So the iris, as you all know, is the colored part of your eye. You know, the main purpose of the eye is to act like a filter for light. So when your eye is exposed to light, the pupil or the iris constricts, so you've got a smaller area, and in dark, it can open up. So as long as your iris can function properly, it can regulate the amount of light going in the eye. If you're in a bright light and your pupil can't constrict, then you can get glare. The light doesn't focus as well. You can get scatter of the light. Conditions that can affect the iris are trauma. Number one, if you get hit in the eye, you might damage those the pupil's ability to open and close. There are some neurologic conditions, third nerve palsies, 80s pupil that can affect, again, how the ability of the eye opens or closes. And so if that iris doesn't respond properly to the amount of light, it can give you some visual disturbance, glare being the main one.
Yeah, it's something actually we see in fighters all the time. When they get punched in the eye, the iris becomes paralyzed. I'm sure I'm going to be seeing some of that tonight at Mohegan Sun for sure.
Yeah, you know, and the other thing I've seen more is I think pickleball is, you know, becoming more popular. And
really?
So I've seen just a rash of pickleball injuries where, you know, you got this wiffle ball in pickleball. But if you get hit in the eye and you don't have eye protection, that iris can become damaged, bleed, and you can end up with other troubles. So, you know, just a public service, if you're playing pickleball, just make sure you get the proper glasses, just like you would with racquetball or any of those sports that have that high-velocity ball, you know, that can really compress the eye. So, so along with fighting, you know, even something that you would do, like for recreational purposes, just making sure that you have eye protection for that reason.
You know, I didn't think of that, and yet, you know, it's so commonplace. If you played racquetball or squash or any of those sports, you always wear eye protection. Didn't think about it, and we're seeing a lot more pickleballers, that's for sure. You mentioned macular degeneration, and you mentioned wet and dry. Can you tell us the differences?
Sure. So the macula is a specialized part of your retina, and it houses the cells that are responsible for fine detail. And when your eye begins to age or the macula begins to age, we begin to see sort of these wear and tear deposits. So the light gets absorbed by the retina, it gets changed into electrical impulse, it gets sent off to the brain, and that whole complex has to regenerate to absorb more light. So over time, we can see something called macular drusen. Drusen are little deposits around those receptors that are a sign of wear and tear. Drusen, if they develop, if you accumulate more of them over time, you can start to reduce the health of that receptor. And that's where we start to kind of change from, you know, aging to early disease. If you have macular drusen, you can see well. You know, we tend to just watch it. We do want you to kind of do some healthy things. Don't smoke, wear your sunglasses, see if you can incorporate into your diet that rainbow of colored, more dark skin fruits and vegetables, those green leafy vegetables. If we start to see changes in the pigment layer around it, then we sort of, you know, sort of shift you into the macular degeneration category, dry, because there's no fluid. In those situations, we like a vitamin. AREDS 2 is one of the vitamins you recommend for that particular stage of macular degeneration, in addition to wearing sunglasses, no smoking, you know, eating your vegetables. If the receptors develop and they break through the tissue underneath and there's blood and fluid, there's more of an inflammatory component to that, the blood vessels begin to change, then that turns you into the wet type. And in the wet type, there are injections that we do now. They're called anti-VEGF or vascular endothelial growth factors. We block those with the injections, and there's various types out there. But they are injections that typically the retina doctors do in their office. Now, it doesn't fix the receptors, but it can stop the leakage. There is a subtype of dry, which, again, I think people have come in asking about. It's that geographic atrophy where it's also known as GA, and that's where the receptors, they atrophy or they die off to the point where there's a blind spot. And the treatment for that in some cases is another injection, but it works on inflammatory pathways, specifically something called the complement pathways. So it blocks the complement that can injure those cells. And so that is something that we like to do earlier in the disease as opposed to once you get the blind spot, because we can't, you know, we can't repair cells that have already gone through that damage phase.
Are these things to get vision better or to just keep it from getting worse?
Yeah. So in the wet form, when there's fluid there, your vision is blurry. And many, many times if that fluid goes away, your vision improves, you know, from when it was wet to when it was dry. So in that case, you know, we want to give you the best vision by stabilizing the condition. With AREDS2, you know, we don't expect you're going to see better, but if we can slow down the process, that would be the goal. And likewise with the injections for the GA, it won't make you see better typically, but if we can slow down and maintain the vision that you have, then that is a more realistic goal.
Another question came in from Michael, and that was, at what point do you use lasers? And I remember lasers when I was in medical school. It was the first time they started using lasers for eye disease. What type of condition makes you think we need to use a laser?
Okay, so laser, there's several different types of laser that we use for the eye. So if we're on the retina, let's talk about that first. So you have a retinal tear or retinal bleed. Laser we use to seal the retinal break so that you don't develop a retinal detachment, because once those cells are detached, they can't absorb light. You can lose your eyesight. So that is probably the most common. We do often seal leaky blood vessels in diabetes now with laser. More we're shifting to injections, but that might be another role for leaky blood vessels, whether in the macula or more peripherally. We do a lot of lasers for glaucoma. That's a different laser called SLT, not the argon laser that we use for the retina. And that's to help lower the pressure or to make an opening so the pressure doesn't go up. So that is a second type of laser that we use. And then there's lasers for the cornea that we use to correct your vision, laser vision correction. We use it to correct astigmatism. And we use it to resurface conditions that where you might have recurrent erosions or abrasions on the cornea. We sometimes use that to resurface the cornea. So that's very, very general in terms of what we do lasers for, but those are the kind of things that you can think about, the cornea for glaucoma and for the retina.
Mary Gina, thank you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your years of support and partnership in this program.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
It's been great to have you as always, and always great to be able to refer people over to you and your staff. Thank you for your time.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you so, so much. And I've got many, many patients that really love your show. And I'm sure they're going to be sad. But anyway, we appreciate all that you do for us as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our guests today. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board. Next week on Healthy Rounds, Dr. Nia Mae Wilson is going to be joining us. She is a breast cancer specialist, and we're going to be talking about that in honor of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. For those of you who wish to continue following our program, even after we get off the air, you know, you can always get the podcast. And the podcast is easily downloaded by going to Apple Podcasts. That's that little purple icon on your iPhone if you have one. And when you go to Healthy Rounds, you go to the upper right-hand corner. There's three dots. You hit those, and you hit follow. And you can keep in touch with us through that, even after our live program goes away. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.